field of medical and bioethics. My father is a physician. Three of my four brothers are physicians. I myself went to medical school before entering the seminary, and I have one brother who's a lawyer, which is why I had to become a priest. You know, we say a doctor, a lawyer, a priest walk into a bar, and we're just telling a family story. Anyway, tonight we're going to talk about beginning of life issues, the moral challenges to human dignity. So we're going to talk a little bit not just about beginning of life issues as it pertains to abortion, but especially the issue of the dignity of the human person and the fundamental cell of our society, which is the family, where we learn about human dignity, we learn how to love. And so I want to start with my own family history a little bit. My parents are immigrants from India. They came to the United States in 1970. They were born as subjects of the King of England. They were part of India's independence movement. My father and mother married in 1963, had two boys in India. My father wanted a better life for his family, wanted to provide. There was a shortage of doctors in the United States because of the Vietnam War. My father passed his U.S. medical licensure exam while still in India, rode his motorcycle to the airport, sold it, came to the United States with $5 to his name, all his possessions in a trunk. The Sisters of Mercy had a job for him at St. Charles Hospital. They gave him money for food for his first few months and for rent. And then after 3 months, he could bring my mom and brothers over to the United States. And they encountered a lot of challenges that many immigrants do. But it was the church who was there for us as an immigrant family. In 1971, 1972, and 1973, my parents had three more boys. So my mother had five boys, born between January 1966 and December of 1973, so she's already done her purgatory. My father practiced medicine until just about 5 years ago. He's an amputee above the knee, and we grew up in just outside Toledo. We actually grew up in the slum on the east side of Toledo, and after I was born, we moved to less of a slum on the further east side of Toledo. Everyone around us were all Americans. We were the only Indian people we knew. There were a few Mexican kids in the neighborhood. But, you know, we grew up at St. Thomas Aquinas Parish on the east side. The reason why we went to St. Thomas Aquinas is that was the local church. But my oldest brother was old enough for school when he came to the United States. And so he went to the public school because we were too poor to go to Catholic school. But my brother was the first non-white student at the school. And the teachers and principal wouldn't let him use the drinking fountains at the same time as the other kids, or the lavatory. So my father said something to the parish priest, "Father, could you help us out at the public school? This is what's happening to my son." And the priest simply said, "Well, doctor, your son can come to our school." And my dad said, "Well, he can't afford to pay." And he said, "Doesn't matter. He's a child of God. He can come to our school." And I never forgot what the priest did, or what he said. Even though I wasn't born, the story is in our family memory. He's a child of God. And that's really what we're going to talk about tonight, is the dignity of the human person. That we're all made in God's image and likeness. We're all children of God. You can see my brothers, Carl and Trevor, on the left with my older brother, Ashley, in 1971. And then this is my brother, Ashley, and me in the upper right corner, probably around 1973. All right. My mother dressed us. I can't take any credit for my outfit. All right. But in the family, all right, all seven of us, all of us have graduate degrees. Three of my brothers are physicians. One's a lawyer. I'm a priest with a doctorate. My mother has master's in social work, guidance counseling, and an ed specialist degree, and my father's a physician. Right? We're all Indian underachievers. Actually, one brother is a pediatrician, also has a doctorate from Georgetown in philosophy. Right, because my mother emphasized strongly education. None of us, of course, went into professional sports. None of us have any criminal records. And we're all still practicing the Catholic faith, thanks be to God. What held us together as a family? Prayer. Right? My mother would always quote Father Peyton, "The family that prays together stays together." And we prayed the rosary every night because of the experience of the immigrants and because of the experience of prejudice. My mother came to a conclusion. You have no one in this country, you're going to have to work for everything, and you're going to have to work hard and pray hard. We prayed the rosary every night. We said our Fathers and Hail Marys. We probably said them more quickly than any kids we knew. You know, so a Hail Mary in our family would be, Hail Mary, full of grace, Lord, Holy Mary, the God, pray for us in the hour of our death. Amen. And my father, if he couldn't understand us, would say from his chair, repeat. And if he said repeat three times, he'd get up from his chair, take off a slipper, hit us, and then we'd have to say our Hail Marys more slowly. Prayer. That's what prayer kept us, our family, in beatings, kept our family together. Cut that out of the tape. Anyway, in addition to praying hard as a family, we went to Mass like clockwork. All of us boys served at the Mass. And our parents, you know, my dad said, well, what can I do for my parish? And he gave all the kids in the Catholic school, and there were maybe 400 kids in the school, he gave them all free physicals so they could be eligible to play sports. It's what people did. My mother volunteered as a counselor. But there was an idea of, in each family, each person was valued, and we prayed together as a family, went to Mass every week, every day we prayed the rosary, with additional prayers at the end of the rosary. My parents took us for confession at least once a month, more often if we needed it. Now, John Paul II, in his letter to families in 1994, said this, families should pray for all of their members in view of the good which the family is for each individual and which each individual is for the whole family. Stop. Children are good for parents. Parents are good for children. Everybody in a family is valued. Prayer strengthens this good precisely as the common good of the family. In prayer, the family discovers itself as the first us, in which each member is I and thou. Each member is for the others. Everyone in a family has value. Everyone is of equal dignity, even though family members carry out different roles. As my nephew, Arav, he's now 8, but even as an infant, he was praying. All right. But today, there are many threats and challenges to the family. We know that in Rome, the synod for the family is going on, but there was a synod on the family in 1980, when the family was also in crisis. And so there are many challenges to the family today, physical challenges, but also philosophical challenges, both to the idea of the family, but especially the human person, who is the first, you know, who is first, the first I, if you will, in the family. I get to take a breath and a sip of water. All right, so what are some of these philosophical challenges? The first challenge to the dignity of the human person is actually, who is a human person? Right? In his reflections on the family, St. John Paul II saw the family as a communion of persons bound up in love. The fundamental unit of value in each family was the human person, but that begs the question, who is a human person? What is his nature? The late Dr. Edmund Pellegrino, who won the Notre Dame Prize, the Laetare Medal in philosophy and ethics, said this, today there's a model that views the person in this way. It says, extrapolations of science's materialist premises produces a bioethics measured by the good of the body or the species, for that is all there is, mind, soul, emotion, spirit, all are simply epiphenomena of matter. There is no reality beyond what we can touch, see, feel, or smell. Suffering is pointless. When the machinery of the body is irreversibly damaged, death can and should be chosen. See, we live in a very scientific world. People say the only thing we can actually know is what we can prove, and the only way we can prove or know anything is through the use of the scientific method. So if one was going to use the scientific method to find the soul, one might not be able to prove, if you will, that the soul exists, or that the afterlife exists, or that the promise of eternal life is true. There is a way of viewing the person simply as a biological animal, and when that animal ceases to function at a high level, the animal, whether a human animal or a non-human animal, loses its value. On the other hand, in competition with the scientific empiricist version of the person, there is the Christian version, understanding of the person. Now, Boethius, who is a philosopher, defined the person as an individual substance of a rational nature. All right? Well, that doesn't mean anything maybe to you. It doesn't mean anything to a lot of our seminarians who look, they have a blank stare on their face when we say that. Right? But a person is actually an individual substance. He has a particular, he or she has a particular nature, and that nature is rational. Now, what we might think of the person in a truly Christian anthropology by considering four factors. A person is made in God's image and likeness. We hear that in the book of Genesis. The person is a unity of body and soul. In the terms of philosophy, the soul is the form of body, the body. Just like in sacraments, we have matter and form. For example, in the Eucharist, the matter is the bread and the wine, and the form is the priest saying over that bread and wine, "This is my body, this is my blood," so as to change it into Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity. Matter and form. The soul is the form of the body. Well, that means our bodies are not just things to be used according to our will. They're part and parcel of who we are. And what affects the soul affects the body, and what affects the body affects the soul. In fact, it affects the whole person. So we not only are we made in God's image and likeness, and our unity of body and soul, but we are also endowed with an intellect so that we can know what is good, right? Unlike other animals which can think at a certain level, we have higher functions, higher intellectual powers. And not only do we have an intellect, but we have free will. We're not just slaves to our biological passions. We can know what is good using our mind, and we can choose what is good using our free will. Those are the four characteristics of a person, as a Christian would conceive him or her. Made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore possess a certain dignity. We are a unity of body and soul. We have an intellect so we can know what is good, and free will so that we can choose what is good. Now, in his letter to families, in reflecting on what it means to be made in the image of God, John Paul II said, "In the image of God is central to the identity of every man and woman. This identity consists in the capacity to live in truth and love. The need of truth and love is an essential dimension of the life of the person." So we're given, created by God in His image and likeness, we are made for others, to live with others, for others, in truth and love. Even yesterday, at the Mass, the readings were from the book, you know, reflected on the book of Genesis. And in Genesis chapter 2, God Himself says, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make for him a suitable helpmate." And then He makes Adam fall asleep. He fashions from his side Eve. Adam sees Eve, and he says, "Ah, at last, this one at last is flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. This one shall be called woman." That is why a man leaves his father and mother's house and cleaves to his wife, and the two become one flesh. If you look at the original language, you see the word for man is ish. The word for woman is ishah. There's a fundamental relationship, even linguistically, in the nature between man and woman. They complement one another, made in God's image and likeness, but Adam recognizes in his flesh that he's made for Eve. He's made to live for her and to live with her. And so we're made to live with and for others, but how? In truth and in love. Every one of us is made to live in truth and in love. And so, that means we also can reflect upon the right of each person to the truth and to love. Now, we can speak of rights, but only when we speak also of corresponding duties. In his encyclical letter, Pacem in Terris, St. John the 23rd spoke of it. If we want to speak about rights, we have to speak about corresponding duties. And we can speak of rights in two ways. We can speak of a positive right and a negative right. A positive right means I have a right to X and someone has a duty to provide me with X. I have a right to an education and you have a duty to provide me with an education. Or a negative right. I have a right to X and someone has a duty not to interfere with how I choose to obtain X. I have a right to practice my religion and everyone else has a duty not to interfere with how I practice my religion. Positive rights and negative rights. But the difference between these two interpretations of rights has fundamental implications for certain issues, especially issues of disability, human sexuality, end-of-life care. You know, do I have a right to food and water? Do you have a duty to provide it for me? Or do I have a right to food and water, but all you have to do is just not interfere with my right to that? All kinds of implications. But the family
is a special place where we learn about rights and duties.
Kids are told to do their chores, pull their weight around the house, because they have a duty. And they say, well, what about my rights? You know, as a child, and parents often say, well, you don't have too many, or limited rights, or you don't have rights because you're not working, or what? Well, everyone has some limited rights, but to what extent? No matter what degree of rights we possess, we ought to exercise those rights in truth and in love. And in the family, we learn about education. And parents have a right to educate their children in every way. They're the primary educators, especially of their children, in the ways of faith. And they have a duty to do so. And the children have a right to learn the Catholic faith in its fullness, for example. So we learn about compassion and caring for the whole person. This morning, our reading at Mass was the parable of Good Samaritan, the one who acted, who was neighbor to him, the one who showed compassion. We learn that also in the family. We learn about understanding freedom is not merely choice. Sometimes we make good choices, sometimes we make bad choices. But our choices in a family are not just about me as an individual. They might have implications for the whole family. I take my brother Ashley. You know, once he wanted to visit his girlfriend who lived up in New York, and he told my mom that he was going to visit his friend Brian in Detroit. But my brother always overpacked because he was overly concerned about how he looked. And his bag weighed too much, and it got left behind at the airport. Well, the airport called saying that he had to pick up the bag. Well, my youngest brother Eustace picked up the phone and heard from the stewards at the airport, oh, the bag got left behind, can someone come and pick it up? So Eustace told me and my friend Miguel and me about it, and so Miguel and I drove to the airport to pick up the bag. Unbeknownst to Eustace and unbeknownst to us, my mom had picked up the phone at the same time. So we went to the airport, picked up the bag, and my mom followed to the airport, went to pick up the bag, and they said, ma'am, someone's already claimed that bag. And she said, well, what did they look like? And she said, well, it was some fat Mexican guy and a scrawny little Indian kid. We took the bag home, went to play tennis, went to get a video. I left Miguel and my youngest brother Eustace at home. My mom came home. I was out getting a video, and I walked back in. Earl, where were you? Oh, I was out getting a video. Where were you before that? Oh, I was playing tennis. Where were you before that? Oh, I was playing tennis. And I looked over at Miguel and Eustace, and they put their heads down, and they had broken under my mother's interrogation tactics. Right? But my mother then said, Earl, Eustace, you guys are grounded. Miguel, I treated you like a son, and this is how you repay me. And then called up my brother Ashley and said, Ashley, I hope you enjoy New York because you're grounded the rest of the summer. And it was only June, right? But actions had consequences for the whole family. You have to learn how to use freedom and consider the common good of everyone. It's not just about my choice, but it's about everyone's choice and freedom. Right? And so we have to make good choices considering everyone. We learn all of those things in the family. But today, sometimes family isn't emphasized. What is emphasized is the individual, particularly in a country like ours where individual liberty is highly prized. People are free to decide for themselves what to do with their bodies and everything else. The only thing that matters is if you respect my choice. Right now in France, in fact, they want to weaken the abortion laws there, and there's a campaign, My Body, My Choice, My Life. Caring is considered non-interference with desires of another, which you have to do. I have my rights, and it's my body, and you ought not to interfere in this sphere of my life, because it's all about me and my choices, and you respect my choices. There's a loss of idea as a person of one who thinks, who acts, who loves and lives in community with another and for another. You see, that is the risk of individualism, right? To think of ourselves, and Pope Francis rails against this, kind of the radical individualism at times, seeking not the good of the poor or the common good. And he's trying to call people back to think about our common home. On the other hand, competing with this individualistic model is a personalist model of understanding the person, which sees that freedom transcends choice. Our freedom has implications for those around us, and actually even for our character. It does affect our character, but it goes beyond just my choices. It has implications.
choosing the truth in love with and for oneself and for another.
So love isn't really a feeling as such. It's a choice. It's a choice for the good of another. When a husband says to his wife, "I do," and the wife says, "I do," back to take the man as her husband, they're choosing each other for the giving and receiving of love. They're choosing what's good for the other, to help that other person get to heaven. And they're willing to make any sacrifice to do it. It's a choice to live with and for another. A person becomes or actualizes himself what he was created to be when he chooses the good. So Matthew Kelly, the dynamic Catholic guy, always says, be the best version of yourself. Right? The only way you can be the best version of yourself is by choosing what is truly good for you, and what is truly good for you is what God has provided for you, or God's will in your life, even though we don't always see that. All right. Get to look at my nephew for a second.
Nice smile.
He does. Have a nice smile. All right. So, one challenge to human dignity is, how do we understand the person? Because we say the person possesses human dignity. A person is made in God's image and likeness, is a unity of body and soul, not a thing, is endowed with intellect so he can choose the good, endowed with free will, endowed with intellect so he can know what is good, endowed with free will so he can choose what is truly good. But the second problem is, if we want to speak of the dignity of the human person, is what do we mean by dignity? You know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from the United Nations, 1948, ground rights in dignity. Jacques Maritain, who is one of the ghostwriters of that, says, well, that's all well and good as long as you don't ask us what dignity means. He had a very clear understanding of what dignity meant. But the idea of dignity in the whole field of bioethics has implications for abortion, embryonic stem cell research, sexual ethics, social justice, human research, organ transplantation, euthanasia, and care of the dead. Do we have dignity? Should we be treated as persons, or do we not? Are we just other animals or things to be disposed of? Again, Pope Francis talks about we live in a culture of a throwaway culture. Two philosophers who have challenged the concept of dignity are Ruth Macklin and Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker is actually more a neurologist. And he basically says dignity is a stupid concept because it's so flexible, it's so fungible, and it's actually harmful. And someone like Ruth Macklin will basically say, what you say is dignity is just simply an imposition of your religious values upon me and depriving me of my rights and my choices. And really what you need to do is show respect for autonomy, my free choice. Only when you show respect for my free choice will you afford me any sense of dignity. But that's because they have a mistaken notion of what dignity is, as do many people in our society today. There are two competing ideas of dignity today: attributed dignity and inherent dignity. And we'll see this again next week when we discuss end-of-life issues. Attributed dignity tends to value a person based on what he or she does, how handsome or beautiful someone might be, what one's job might be, how wealthy or influential a person might be. Different attributes give a person his or her worth. But then when a person is not so young, not so handsome, not so beautiful anymore, loses one's athletic ability, cannot function anymore, loses a job, has health problems and so on, can't go the way they used to be able to go, people speak of losing their dignity, suffering indignities, particularly at the end of life when people lose control of their bodily functions. This tends to value a person based on what he or she does or what he or she has, rather than who he or she is. In contrast, we have the concept of inherent dignity. Inherent dignity values the person based on who or she is before the person has done even a single thing. Not based on what job you have or what you look like or where you come from or how athletic or not you are. You have dignity in virtue of being a person. Not merely in virtue of being a person, but I would say also because there will never be another person exactly like you. You see, dignity is not just an abstract concept, but it's also rooted in experience, which is both known and felt. We are not merely our consciousness. Not merely
are mine. No one says to me, "Oh, Father, I love you," or "mine." They say, "I love you." And they would say the same to any one of us. It's not just our choices. "Oh, you make good choices, Father. That's why I love you." No, there's something more to the person than just his or her choices.
There's also the relationships. Like, I love my parents because of who they are, and they gave me life, and they've made me who I am, as well as my brothers who have helped shape, fashion, and mold me. All of these things also help me to be the person I am today. Dr. John Crosby, who teaches philosophy up at Franciscan University of Steubenville, speaks of a twofold source of dignity. One is in our makeup, right? We're made in God's image and likeness, comes from on high. But another thing, he says it doesn't rest just in things we have in common, like we are all individual substances of a rational nature, right, and a reason, but also because we're unique. There will never be another person just like us. God made us just the way we are for himself, for love. He chose to do this for us. Even if one didn't believe in God, genetically, other than identical twins who also have different personalities, there will never be another person just like us. And therefore, all persons are equal in dignity because we share the same nature that we have in common, and yet we're all unique. But love is one way we discover the dignity of persons. We might discover a person's dignity through individual actions or choices, but that's not the only way, right? Choice and dignity are not identical concepts. An inherent human dignity, not rooted in one's choice or how smart one is or what work one has, is the best protection for the person and the family. Because you know what? People said to my parents, "You're not the same as we are because the color of your skin is brown." Said to my brothers, you don't have the same dignity because you are poor and you're brown. We weren't actually allowed, my parents forbade us from telling any of our classmates what my father did for a living, because we lived in a poor neighborhood, and essentially in a slum. My father didn't want anyone to value us because he was a doctor. Rather, we were the people from the neighborhood who went to the church with the other people from the neighborhood, because he saw there's more to it than just your job. There's the content of one's character and the immortality of one's soul and the uniqueness of each person. But God has endowed us with dignity, which is a gift and a call, and it makes demands upon us. John Paul II, he wrote a book before he became Pope called Person and Community. And it says, "The matter of the dignity of the human person is always more a call and a demand than an already accomplished fact. Or rather, it is a fact worked out by human beings, both in the collective and individual sense." What is he saying? We have a collective duty, as well as an individual duty, to protect the dignity of the person. That is, we have a responsibility for one another. It was 20 years ago that he wrote his encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. And in that encyclical letter, he spends a lot of time meditating upon the story of Cain and Abel. You know, Cain slays his brother Abel, and then he goes out, and God comes to Cain and says, "Where's your brother Abel?" And of course, Cain arrogantly says to God, "What, am I my brother's keeper?" And the answer to that question for every Catholic is yes. We are each other's keepers. We look out for one another. And we speak of that as the virtue of solidarity, which of course, John Paul II would have known all too well growing up in Poland. The truth of the dignity of persons places demands on all of us. From the weakest to the strongest, we must defend each other. It's true in the relationship between the doctor and the patient, right? The doctor sees the patient being sick and in need, and without the technical skills to get well, and the doctor, recognizing the patient's dignity, puts himself or herself at the dignity of the sick person, wanting that person to get well. And we see life and health as a great good. The same is true with parents and children. Might be consoling to know to parents that one of the most confessed sins by children, besides fighting and biting and kicking and not doing one's homework and not doing something the first time they're asked is, I sass back to my parents, I disrespected my parents. It's a recognition by children. Oh, there is someone in authority to me. I haven't been good to my parents, they'll say. They even get emotional. Might be disconsolating to parents that shortly after that, the next one that breaks their heart the most is they didn't look after their animal. Anyway, we've been talking about the dignity of the human person, made in God's image and likeness. But the tiniest of persons, the human embryo, at the moment of fertilization, the church teaches that human life begins. And as such, the embryo ought to be treated as a person. At that moment, we have the genetic makeup that we are going to have. We're going to continue to develop, and all the programming for us to develop into an adult is there. Nothing will change in our nature from the moment of conception. But oftentimes, pregnancies are ended in the womb through abortion. What does the church teach about abortion? Of course, the church teaches that abortion is always wrong. No good intention, no circumstances could ever make that action wrong. It's the direct taking of an innocent human life, life of a person made in God's image and likeness. 50 years ago, the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world, called Gaudium et Spes, at the Second Vatican Council, said this. But the church issues the reminder that true contradiction cannot exist between divine laws pertaining to the transmission of life and pertaining to authentic conjugal love. For God, the Lord of life, has conferred on men and women the surpassing ministry of safeguarding life in a manner which is worthy of man. We have a duty to safeguard human life. Therefore, from the moment of its conception, life must be guarded with the greatest care, while abortion and infanticide are unspeakable crimes. Right? These were things that the pagans did. And from the early church, from the time of the Didache and the Didache of the Apostles, abortion was prohibited. We could even look at the Hippocratic Oath in the pagan world and to see that it prohibited doctors from abortion because the medicine was the art of healing. But the Second Vatican Council spoke of abortion and infanticide as unspeakable crimes. But within 10 years, most Western nations had legalized abortion. Certainly, in the United States in 1973, by a Supreme Court decision, not elected officials, all the laws in the United States regarding abortion were struck down. I think about that often because I was born in September of 1972. I think about the empty pews in church. I would think about the empty seats in the classroom. I think about the seminarians and the priests we don't have, and the classmates and friends I didn't have, and the geniuses that weren't born. I think about that every day. And everyone here ought to think about how rich our community might be by a unique individual whose life, for whatever reason, was snuffed out. We shouldn't make it out to be, oh, they're just people who want to kill innocent, defenseless people. You know, there are some callous people like that. We have heard and seen these Planned Parenthood videos, right? But there are many people who find themselves in difficult situations, whose freedom is somewhat limited and don't know what to do. And they panic. And we need to be there to support them so that they choose life. But for whatever reason, they choose not to carry pregnancy to term, and they extinguish a human life. Codified in law, and some people equate something being legal with something being moral. Yet we as Catholics also have the commandment in the old law, thou shalt not kill. But already, in 1974, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith had to issue a document, Declaration on Procurative Abortion, clarifying church teaching. The Second Vatican Council had spoken of abortion as an unspeakable crime. Now there are Catholic theologians calling this into question. People wondering, could we do this in a Catholic hospital even? Could we not only commit abortion but also do sterilizations in a Catholic hospital? And so the church said at that time, no, these things are always wrong. 20 years later, John Paul II wrote his encyclical letter. Because in the Western world, especially, abortion was being promoted as a person's right to choose, but also as a way to control the populations. It was also always interesting to me how you know, the people who are all in favor of population control all happen to live in the northern part of the world with all the money and all the power, and they were always saying, well, there are too many black people, too many brown people, too many yellow people who are using up all the world's resources, right? John Paul II was aware of this type of ideology, what Pope Francis also calls an ideology of colonization, the colonial type of ideology. In 1995, he spoke very clearly about what the church teaches about abortion, and he said this: therefore, by the authority which Christ conferred upon Peter and his successors, and in communion with the bishops of the church, Catholic Church, I confirm that the direct and voluntary killing of an innocent human being is always gravely immoral. This doctrine, based upon the unwritten law which man in the light of reason finds in his own heart, is reaffirmed by sacred scripture, transmitted by the tradition of the church, and taught by the ordinary and universal magisterium. It is not just that we can know this teaching through the scriptures and the tradition, through revealed truth, but we can know it by reason alone. And therefore, he is also making an appeal to men and women of goodwill. You can understand that human life begins at conception. My sister-in-law is a Hindu. She's a physician, but she refuses to prescribe birth control or perform abortions or refer for them, because at the level of reason, she recognizes that this is wrong. John Paul II continued, therefore, by the authority which Christ conferred upon Peter and his successors in communion with the bishops who on various occasions have condemned abortion and who in aforementioned consultation, albeit dispersed throughout the world, have shown a unanimous agreement concerning this doctrine, I declare that direct abortion, that is, abortion willed as an end or as a means, always constitutes a grave moral disorder, since it is the deliberate killing of an innocent human being. This doctrine is based upon the natural law, upon the written word of God, as transmitted by the church's tradition and taught by the ordinary and universal magisterium. No good intention, not even surrounding circumstances, which might be understandable, could ever make the killing of an innocent and defenseless person okay or neutral. But some people choose it, and we wonder why. In his letter opening the year of faith, Pope Benedict XVI said this: the important thing today, as was the desire of the Council Fathers, is that we see clearly and anew that God is present, that he is watching over us, that he responds to us, and that by contrast, when faith in God is found wanting, all that is essential crumbles, because man loses his profound dignity and what makes his humanity great in the face of every form of reductionism. St. Alphonsus Liguori, 3 centuries earlier, said, if God is lost, all is lost. Right? If we do not have a sense of being made in God's image and likeness, then why doesn't might make right? Why aren't we just the sum total of our biological parts and nothing more? Why isn't it just survival of the fittest? Really, the issue of abortion and human dignity, what Benedict XVI is saying, it's a crisis of faith. Can we search for God and find him? And in finding him, come to understand something of ourselves. John Paul II said this in his first encyclical letter, The Redeemer of Man. The more man comes to know Christ, the more he comes to know himself. And it is that that keeps us conscious. Jesus came to save each and every person upon this earth, fragile and weak and sinful as we are, and he would do it over again if he had to, even if we were the only person upon this world. And that is how valuable we are and precious we are in the sight of God. Some people think, oh, you know, Pope Francis is a liberal pope. He's a progressive pope. He's going to change church teaching about everything. Well, what does Pope Francis actually have to say about abortion? Following in the tradition of John Paul II and Benedict XVI and all their predecessors who spoke also of human ecology, Pope Francis, in his letter Evangelii Gaudium, says this: among the vulnerable for whom the Church wishes to care with particular love and concern are unborn children, the most defenseless and innocent among us. Most defenseless and innocent. Not defenseless and innocent, but the most defenseless and innocent. Vulnerable persons whom the Church wishes to care for with a particular love. That is, we have a collective duty as a Church to defend the most vulnerable. Nowadays, efforts are made to deny them their human dignity and to do with them whatever one pleases, taking their lives and passing laws preventing anyone from standing in the way of this. Right? What was once a crime, other people are now saying is a right. Laws preventing anyone from standing in the way of this. Right? People are saying, look, this embryo is a thing that can be experimented upon. Maybe some here are old enough to remember Second World War when other persons were experimented upon without their consent and the death camps. We need to be thinking about this as well. Frequently, as a way of ridiculing the church's efforts to defend their lives, attempts are made to present her position as ideological, obscurantist, and conservative. Yet this defense of unborn life is closely linked to the defense of each and every other human right. Without the right to life, all your other rights become in jeopardy. And when a candidate says to me, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but is unwilling to defend the right to life of the most vulnerable, that to me is also saying, I don't know, it says to me, well, or I say to myself, I'm not sure he's going to defend the rights of the elderly or the poor either. If he's not willing to defend the most innocent and most defenseless, how can I be assured of that? And so it's a real question and a real duty that all our rights are in jeopardy if we don't defend the right to life of the unborn. Who's saying this? Pope Francis. He continues, it involves the conviction that a human being is always sacred and inviolable in any situation at every stage of development. Human beings are ends in themselves and never a means of resolving other problems. What is he saying? Human beings possess inherent dignity. They are made in God's image and likeness, made for communion with God and for others. Human beings are not just their bodies to be used of and disposed of, but their unity of body and soul. They possess an immortal soul. They can't just be treated like things to be thrown away. Once this conviction disappears, so do solid and lasting foundations for the defense of human rights, which would always be subject to the passing whims of the powers that be. Right? If dignity is not rooted in just being a person, and if rights aren't rooted in this inherent human dignity, then what are they rooted in? They would be rooted in the will of the legislator. And that means that the people who can influence the legislators will rule this world. Who has that? The people with the most money and the most power. And where does that leave everyone else? Vulnerable. And those same people with the money and the power can also then say to the poor and the weak, and the vulnerable, and the elderly, and the handicapped, we're changing the law, and you lose your rights. That is what fundamentally is at stake. Every right becomes jeopardized if we lose this concept of human dignity, and it starts with the right to life of the unborn. I'll take a breath. Are there any questions at this point?
How long are we going, by the way?
As long as you want to go, but up to an hour and a half.
Okay. So we've been going 45 minutes. Are there any questions? Anyone warned out? Yeah.
What about a woman, they claim the abortion to save a woman's life? What about that situation?
All right, abortion to save a woman's life. The number of actual medical cases when a woman's life is truly threatened by pregnancy is few, almost none, given modern medicine. But let's imagine a woman had a cancer of the uterus and she's pregnant. Could she have an abortion in order to then go undergo chemotherapy and so on and so forth? The church's answer to that question is no. The direct taking of an innocent human life is always wrong, right? The child has a right to life. But the woman also has a right to her life. But let's imagine the doctor said, look, you have a cancerous uterus. We could remove that uterus. We can foresee that the child will also die. The action of the child dying is foreseen but not intended. It is beside the intention. Is there a legitimate or proportionate reason for doing so? Yes. Is evil done that good may come from it? No, no evil is done in the sense of taking the child's life directly. Rather, a good is done, namely, the cancerous uterus, which is threatening the life of the mother, is removed. So, a woman has a right to her life. St. Thomas, in his consideration of the principle of self-defense, says we do have a right to life and a right to defend our own life. In fact, Aristotle would say we have a natural inclination towards self-preservation. But in considering self-preservation, one's right to self-defense, St. Thomas says to defend one's life, one may only use the amount of force proportionate to defend one's life. So if someone is going to attack me, what do I try to do? I try to run away. What if I can't run away? Well, then I try to kick him in the shins and run away. What if I have to throw a punch? I can throw a punch, but I can't throw a punch with the intention to kill, because that ceases to be a defensive sort of action. So we have to say, what am I choosing to do? Consider intention, why am I choosing to do it? And then consider the surrounding circumstances. The number of cases in which both the right to life of the mother and the child are threatened are few and far between. So we consider then the principle of self-defense, what is considered to be a defensive type of action, and what is a woman acting in accordance with the natural inclination. Okay? So there are very few medical conditions. So if you ask some obstetricians, they'll say almost none. And so you should always try to prolong pregnancy, and then maybe, you know, so this is where they're developing some technologies, maybe artificial womb technology that might be able to save a child's life. Or children today are viable anywhere between 20 and 24 weeks. You know, they're very risky pregnancies, right? But that's why European abortion laws are usually between 20 and 24 weeks is when abortion is legal, is because they see the child as being viable at that point. Now, that might be a bad standard, but that's the standard they use. But still, if we can get to that point, well, then the child has a right to life. Sometimes there are problem pregnancies, ectopic pregnancies, or even pregnancies where you can see essentially like Siamese twins developing. And some people will say, well, you should, certainly the weaker twin is not going to make it. So let's try to save the stronger twin. But when we think about that, you know, some people say, well, at least one will survive. It's a very utilitarian sort of calculus. But in fact, what it means is taking the life of another individual who also has the right to life in order to save. It'd be one thing if the weaker was volunteering, saying, I will, like people do when in military action, I'm going to throw myself on the bomb to save my whole platoon. Greater love than this no one has than to lay down one's life for one's friends. But to say, I'm going to throw you on the bomb to save others without your wanting to, is a different type of action altogether. And so we have to consider the fundamental right to life of each individual, both the mother and the child. And often the child's right to life is the one that's not considered, only the woman's choice. And whether it's about the definition of marriage today or the right to life, everyone wants to make everything about the adults. Now that we have a few children with us, all right, he'll be happy to make me say, well, you know what, children have rights too, including the right to life, okay? And so we want to show respect for both and love them both. All right, other questions? Yeah.
How do you share God's love with a mother or father who's had an abortion, knowingly it was wrong, but peer pressure, the position they were in, no support, family, friends, whatever, felt that was their only option?
And so they felt that was their only option.
Right.
And that maybe that's all they could see. So we ought not to judge them in the sense, you know, because what involves mortal sin is grave matter, the knowledge of the church's teaching, and deliberate consent of the will. And John Paul II talks about that in Evangelium Vitae. It's not just that women callously want to kill their children. In fact, that's seldom the case. Sometimes they're told by doctors, you have to do this. Sometimes their life is threatened. Sometimes they're pressured by their boyfriends. I know so many women whose mother and father drove them to the clinic and pressured them, right? They didn't have much of a choice. Others felt like, or were told, look, you need to get your education. This is the only solution. You'll ruin your whole future. And later on, they experienced regret. One is being truthful about the reality, right? The American Psychiatric Association is not truthful. They say women never suffer any depression or psychological effects from abortion. I can tell you as a priest, as a confessor, they do. As a counselor, they do. There are things like, you know, I'm on the board of the Pregnancy Center East in my spare time, right? And so there's a thing called Let In Light Again, Lila. And Lila exists for women to just start talking to others about their experience. They're not yet ready for something like Project Rachel, which exists in the church. You just need to begin to talk so they can get to the point of acknowledging what they did, but also acknowledging what they're experiencing. Sometimes it's years, decades later, that it comes up. Then there's also things like Project Rachel, which helps support, provide post-abortive counseling and support. Probably one in five Catholic women, one in five women in our country have had an abortion, maybe more, right? And so are experiencing this trauma and have had to live with it and carry this burden with them. I tell you, a few years ago, a woman stopped me after Mass. You know, it was a busy Sunday. I was at Guardian Angels Parish, shaking hands. Father, can I talk to you for a minute? I want to meet with you. And I said, well, here's my card, call me. And I had a full schedule the next day. And I was kind of hoping she wouldn't call. I didn't know what it was about. It was an older woman. And she called up the very next day and said, Father, I'd like to come and see you. I'd like to bring my sister with you. She said, Father, I started to come back to church after about 30 or 40 years. I always believed in God, but I was raised Catholic, and my mother took us to church and everything. I never would have thought of myself as anything but. But my sister and I have been away for a while. And they both talked about, in the 1960s, having an abortion. And they carried that with them for 40-something years, more than 40 years. But they heard God's word at Mass. It pierced their hearts, and they wanted to come back. So, well, we could go down to the chapel and I could hear your confession. I'll help you. And so they went to confession. And I said, you can go behind the screen or you can come face to face. And I said, face to face, what's that? I said, well, you can see the priest's face now, or you can go behind the screen and be anonymous. And one woman said, I think I'd like that face to face. And the other and her sister said, Mom didn't teach us that way. I'm going behind the screen. Right. So the first one, sister came, and I gave her a penance, and then the other one came. And then I said, they were both kneeling down doing their penance. And I said, well, would you like to go to communion? And they got all teary-eyed. And so I went to the tabernacle and got the host. And I said, well, you could receive communion standing or kneeling. And one says, I think I'd like to receive standing. I've seen people do that now. And the other said, that's not how Mom told us. And I gave them both the Lord and the Eucharist. And they went and they had tears in their eyes. Father, Mom would be so happy. We're so happy. Mom would be so happy. I'm sure she's looking down on us with love from heaven. Later on that night, I saw the rector of the seminary, and he said, well, how was your day? I said, so busy. But I said, I think I did more good today than in all my years of priesthood combined. It's not impossible, but women need to know that people will listen to them without judging them, that there is hope for them, and that there is mercy for them. That the absolution, the word of forgiveness by God, is true. It doesn't mean that they haven't done what they've done. It doesn't mean that they won't somehow carry that with them, right, in some way. But it's not imputed to their soul, and they can be free. And then it's healing, being a part of a community, a church, that will support them. You see, I think that's one of the things people like, where do I even begin to come back? Another part is to think about is the conditions which led to that. Where were the men? That's part of it. Some of them pressured the women. Some of them were jumped ship. Some of them, though, wanted their child and weren't allowed to be part of that. Right? And so a lot of men are mourning, too. Some are regretting the abortions they pressured or didn't stop. Some are regretting just giving the financial assistance or driving the woman down to the clinic. Some are mourning the loss of the children they wanted but couldn't have because it wasn't about their choice. And so men are hurting too. And in that way, also in terms of responsibility for men in this, there's an issue that has to be addressed. Why are we teaching men and women to think about themselves as individuals rather than being made for life and love? And that goes back to the family and the common good. So our concept of family is important. In 1986 in Perth, John Paul II said, as the family goes, so goes the nation, so goes the future of our world. Mm-hmm. And it's important to think about that. But that also means, as Pope Francis talks about, helping the poor all the time, and economic justice, and he's seemingly ranting against capitalism, at least, you know, capitalism without ethics, or without virtue, or without the gospel, right? Individualism, materialism, all this sort of thing. Why? Because when you're poor and you're struggling to survive, it's hard for people to say, I'm going to bring a new life into this world because I have responsibility for this little one now, and how am I going to provide? Right? And that's where that creating economic conditions that can actually support a family and fighting for a living wage that supports families is also important in building the culture of life. But let's imagine some people just have a block. They can't get over it. Or they're unrepentant. What is our responsibility toward them? Church always proposes, she never imposes. But I'll tell you what. Are you fasting for that person? Are you praying for that person? Are you doing holy hours of reparation for that person? Are you praying and supporting the people who work in crisis pregnancy centers? You know, you do that long enough and you get worn down. Everybody can do a part. Can you help sort and fold clothes by volunteering? Can you find somebody who's got diapers when a mother needs diapers? Can you help raise money for pregnancy centers so that people can see the ultrasound and see the little baby within? All of those things can be support. What about the doctors and nurses? Who is shaping and forming them? I tell you, when I was a medical student, they told us, presume a 15-year-old girl is sexually active and put her on the pill, with or without her consent. Right? The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists is so ideologically driven that they say that doctors should not be able to opt out for conscience reasons. And if they could, they ought to live or have to have their practices in regions where there are other abortion providers. Right? They simply see conscience as something subjective and individualistic rather than objective. And our doctors and nurses are coming under heavy pressure, and our Catholic hospitals as well. And you have to be board certified. What's happening? All the Catholic, you have very few Catholic obstetricians and gynecologists. Very few, and they need our support and encouragement as well. So lots of things. There are lots of things we can do, not just for the woman who's had the abortion, right? But also by helping to build a culture of life for other people who are engaged in the care and nurturing of human life. Sometimes a person's pondering it, right? And they ask for advice. And we don't want to judge, but we also sometimes fail to give them the advice they need, what will truly be good for them. Because we don't want them to think of ourselves as judgmental. But it's only the truth and love that can set a person free. So we have to tell them the truth. But here's what I really think, and here's why. And that's why sessions like this are so important. But you have to be willing to put yourself out there and take a risk. So right after I came back from Rome, I got called to give ethical counsel for Grand Rounds, a case study for physicians at a hospital. And so they're examining a case of a woman who was pregnant, very late pregnancy, and she suspected that her husband was having an affair, and she was pregnant with his child. And so she starts bleeding. And so she calls, and the nearest hospital is Good Sam Hospital, where abortions aren't performed. And Good Samaritan Hospital, though, treats both mother and child as patients, right? But her doctor did not have the privileges at Good Sam. So she called her doctor, and she's in the ER, and they're saying, you know, doc, tell her to allow us to work on her, to save the child. And she's saying, no, I don't want someone cutting on me who I don't know. And the doctor's pleading with her on the phone, Let them do this, otherwise your baby's going to die. And she won't. And she calls her husband busy signal, calls her husband busy signal. And they're wheeling her down to the delivery room. Finally, she gets a hold of her husband. They're watching on the screen her bleed out. And they're watching it, and they're saying, look, ma'am, you have to have this. And finally, she gets a hold of the husband. And the husband says, have the child. Let them do this. They deliver the baby. Apgar scores a 0, 0, and 0. The baby dies. And the next morning, the woman says to the doctor, when he comes in to see how she's doing, says, are you the doctor who killed my baby? Now, the doctor didn't kill the baby, and the woman obviously saying that because she's mourning the loss of her child. But it was a much more sociological issue. She wanted to hear from her husband that he wanted the child. The outcome is one that nobody feels good about. Not the mother, not the doctor, not anyone in that room. Could it have been avoided? In the grand rounds, one of the doctors asked, well, explain this to me. Why should I risk a felony battery charge and losing my medical license on a potentially viable fetus? That's what's going through his mind, right? Perhaps it's a question of the virtue of fortitude. Why should I be courageous to lay down my life for someone who is weak and vulnerable? Am I willing to put myself out there? I'll tell another story with a better ending. When my father came home, I must have been about 10 years old, came home from the hospital, and he looked worried, and he's sitting there, and I said, well, what's the matter? You look worried, you look tired. And he said, well, I have a patient, and she's supposed to have three children. She has triplets. And I said, oh, that's great. And she says, yeah, but she's not really my patient. It's another doctor's patient. And he's telling her that it's a risky pregnancy and that I need to transfer her to his hospital, and they'll take two of the babies out. And I said, take two of the babies out? And he put his head down. And I knew what he meant, even as a 10-year-old child. And my father said, but I'm not going to let him do it. I don't care if they take my license, I'm not going to let him do it. And he went back to the hospital the next day and he says, ma'am, do you want your children? And she said, yeah. And he said, your doctor wants to transfer you to take two of your children out, to destroy those two children. I'm not going to let him do it. I'm not going to sign the transfer order. But that means you need a doctor. Could I be your doctor? I will visit you every day. And the woman said, that'd be fine. And sure enough, she gave birth to three baby boys, all healthy. She named the first one Sydney after my dad. And they put the picture of the triplets up on the wall at the hospital. What a difference courage can make. You see, and that's where Catholics have to find courage. Right? My family, my father, had to support my mom and five boys. Requires courage. I'll tell you a story about my youngest brother. He was a medical student. He was doing a rotation at a Catholic hospital in Columbus. He had a woman who was developmentally disabled, who was pregnant. And he had talked to this woman about having her child, and she wanted to have her child, but the attending physician recommended that she be transferred for an abortion. My brother said, wait a minute, this is a Catholic hospital, we can't do this. And I talked to this patient, and she says she wants to have her child. And the attending physician said, if you say anything, I will see that you fail this rotation. My brother brought it to the ethics board of the hospital, and on a split decision, they sided with my brother, and the woman gave birth to a child, a life that exists today. What are you prepared to do to defend the weak and the vulnerable? I think this is a question that Catholics must ask. I grew up in a family we were particularly blessed. I can't say enough about my parents, my brothers. They're great people. Not every family has that. But that is why strengthening the family is so important. You see, if we have weak families, we have a weak church. If people have not experienced mercy and love in their families, how could they ever think, I could go home? I could face my mother and father again, or face the priest again? How could they ever do that if at first they haven't been held and loved and know that love is permanent. Love is lasting. That is also why divorce is so traumatic for children, because they wonder, can I hand myself over to another later? Can there be a stable structure in which children can experience God's love and grow? You see, that is the fundamental crisis of the family. What if someone has never prayed or hasn't been taught how to pray or learn how to pray in the family, to turn to God when they have to make a big decision, or to try to see that there's always hope? You see, it's so much more it's easy for us to say, oh yeah, they should make good choices all the time. But not everyone has the background and the upbringing that we have had and has the gifts. And because we have been given great gifts by God, much more will be demanded of us. But there's some basic things that we take for granted that not everyone has. A mother and a father to hear, I love you, or I forgive you. That there is hope for you. Pope Francis, the World Meeting for Families, talked about this. He said, you know, children are important. He said, I wanted to talk about two things in the family, two groups of people that deserve special care. Children and grandparents, the elderly. Children, because they carry with them the hope of their parents and grandparents, the hope of the family, lives on in the children. In them we see our future, and the future of the whole world, which is why beginning of life issues are so important. When we consider grandparents, so he says, you know, the elderly grandparents, they are the memory of the family. Right? They've learned from their experiences. They have something to hand on to us. And so he says, you know, a civilization that does not care for its children and its elderly is a civilization that is without hope and without memory. And that's why the whole hope of our world rests on the family. You know, echoing what John Paul II had said in Perth in 1986, as the family goes, so goes the world, so goes the nation, so goes our world. And I think that's so important. And when people are suffering from divorce, suffering from abortion, suffering from lots of different things, poverty, that's all part of the gospel of life. John Paul II also reflected on the devotion. Now, I'm biased. I'm at Sacred Heart Church. Okay? But on the devotion to the Sacred Heart. Right? About God's mercy, God's love, all this sort of thing. But part of the devotion to the Sacred Heart was on Thursdays before First Fridays doing holy hours of reparation and reflecting on the theology of reparation. He talked about the 20th century. So not just abortion, but also two great wars, the Depression, the communist period, and the great lack of respect for the dignity of the human person. And he said he looked at the 20th century as rubble and ash. He says a new foundation needs to be built first. And that's what really these holy hours of reparation can do. They can help lay the foundation for the building up of what he called a civilization of love. And that's the task, right? At the dawn of the new millennium still, that remains our collective task, to build a civilization of love where every member of the family is valued. Not just of our family, but of all families, of the human family and this human in this common earth. We have a common care for the earth and all that is in it as good stewards of creation. And I think that's where those involved with the pro-life movement can begin to see the vocation. And parents as well, married couples, stewards of the gift of human life, stewards of the gift of love. Okay, other questions? I have about 30 more slides, which I'm not going to do tonight, because they deal with infertility and frozen embryos and the dignity of the person, tiniest person. Yet if you read Pope Francis' encyclical letter, Laudato Si, article number 120 talks about the embryo and the value of the embryo. And again, he talks about if you're not willing to protect these tiniest, you're not going to be caring for the whole world. And we all have this common care. So if I were to summarize, I would say, look, the principle of the dignity of the human person, no matter how small, no matter how big. That's fundamental for the whole gospel of life. Within the gospel of life, we also have to say, answer this fundamental question. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my sister's keeper? And the answer for us is yes. Being pro-life is about being pro-life, not being against abortion. Being pro-life means being a people of life and celebrating life and being the best versions of yourself today and worshiping the God of life who loves each and every creature that he has made, for he has made them beautifully. All right, thank you very much.